So this story, like the past several weeks, starts out with Jesus on a boat. And he's been kind of going back and forth from one side of the sea to the next. And it's sort of like, you know, there's the good part of town where all your friends live, and then there's that other part of town that maybe you're not really supposed to go to. And, you know, since Eileen isn't here and I have unlimited time, I'd really love to spend a good solid chunk talking about the differences of miracles, because Jesus does really cool stuff on both sides of the sea. So in and of itself, the fact that Jesus goes back and forth healing and performing miracles, that's a really significant thing. But Hannah's shaking her head no. So apparently I don't have unlimited time. So we'll just, like Jesus, we'll just keep moving. So Jesus crossed back over the sea once again. So he's on the side where his followers are from. And in this story, we actually hear two different stories kind of meshed into one. One kind of interrupts the other. We first hear about Jairus' daughter, who's 12 years old. And then this gets interrupted by a woman who's been hemorrhaging for 12 years, so for the life of this child. And then eventually we circle back to Jairus' daughter. The whole scene is a little bit chaotic, and sometimes it can take a few rounds through to kind of figure out and sort through what's all going on. But as soon as Jesus gets off the boat this time, crowds of people surround him and walk with him and his disciples. And again, throughout Mark's gospel, Jesus is continually trying to find moments to get away, moments of quiet and stillness, for this reason, because whenever he's out in public, people flock to him. So then a man named Jairus notices this crowd wandering along, and he starts approaching Jesus. And the story notes that Jairus is a religious leader, so he's pretty important in the village, meaning he can just show who he is and work his way through the crowd to get right up to Jesus. But he doesn't speak to Jesus face to face. In a gesture of humility, Jairus kneels down at Jesus' feet with his face to the ground. He says, "My daughter is sick. She's laying near death. Please come, lay your hands on her." And as Jesus turns and begins to walk with Jairus toward his house, we get an unnamed woman who pushes her way through the crowd. She's spent all of her money, all of her energy, all of her time on treatments, and none of them have worked. It's implied that she's used up all of her resources and she's now out of options. And she too reaches out to Jesus, but she doesn't come up face to face. She comes from behind and just barely reaches out to grab his coat, his cloak. And the story says instantly she feels healing in her body. Now before, when Jairus walks up to Jesus, Jesus doesn't really say much. He just starts walking. But as soon as this woman touches his cloak, Jesus stops everything with one question. Who touched me? Who touched me? Now think for a moment the last time that you were touched. You know, maybe you're holding hands with someone right now, or your shoulders or your knees are millimeters away and you kind of bump against each other. But who was the last person to touch you? When you were passing the peace, can you name each person who might have extended a hand or a gesture? When was the last time, and who was the last person to touch you? Jairus asks Jesus to come lay hands on his daughter. And from our pews, as comfortable as they may be, we kind of lose some of the impact of that request. Jesus is often, for us, portrayed as a healer. So for us, yeah, sure, it makes sense. Someone comes and asks Jesus for healing. But Jairus, as a leader in the community, he is affirming Jesus' authority as a healer by asking Jesus to come to his home. He risks not being there for his daughter's final breath, risking all of that for the hope that if this works, she will keep taking breath after breath after breath. So either Jairus recognizes the power of Jesus' touch, or he at least assumes that something's got to be there. But again, Jesus stops walking. Who touched me? His disciples immediately dismiss him. Look at the crowd. How can you ask who touched you? There's too many people. Keep going. We got stuff to do today, Jesus. But Jesus doesn't keep going. He waits. He looks around. He searches the crowd until the woman comes forward. And in this moment, she mimics what Jairus did earlier, and she falls at Jesus' feet and tells her whole story to him. Jesus then speaks tenderly to the woman, calling her daughter. And again, from where we sit, we miss the significance that previously this woman didn't have a name, but Jesus calls her daughter, daughter of Abraham, which identifies her as one of God's beloved chosen people. So in a moment of fear, Jesus offers this woman peace along with the healing she's already received. And then this moment, we think it's sweet and it's just beginning to build, and then the crowds pull at Jesus again and say, something else has happened. Jairus's daughter has died. Jesus, go on your way. Go do something else now. There's no need for you. But when Jesus tells the crowd, no, she's not died. She has not died. She's simply sleeping. They laugh at him. Again, no one seems to believe Jesus, which is ironic from where we sit again. But he continues on to Jairus's home. He brings the parents into the room and closes the door. He leans in, takes her hand and whispers, little girl, wake up. And she wakes up and begins to move around. And again, in this moment of fear and chaos, Jesus says, bring her something to eat. She's probably hungry after all that. On the one hand, it might be a little bit easier for us to look at this story through the eyes of the women, the ones who we assume received healing from Jesus. Maybe it brings us hope or encouragement, thinking that if these two could ask something of God, maybe we could too. But I also think that Jesus is changed in this story as well. I mean, after all, he's surrounded by a crowd, a man approaches him, and then someone Jesus doesn't know touches him without his knowledge. His friends dismiss it. Later, the crowds laugh at him. It's chaotic. But Jesus knows from that one touch that something's up. This touch means something. Or maybe when we look at the story, we get a sense of sympathy for the little girls like Jairus's daughter. Who are the young children today among us who are in jeopardy of illness or lack of basic health care or other necessities? What would it take? What kind of miracle would need to be birthed within our own hearts for us to transform the world's systems, to secure a future for all the vulnerable children? And likewise, what happens when these babies grow up and become bodies that bleed and cry and are afraid? The young girl's parents had wailers and mourners, people crying outside the house. Her father left her bedside to go seek help. But what about the unnamed woman who falls at Jesus' feet? Who's caring for her? Who's crying with her when she's out of resources, when her life is turned upside down? In our Christian tradition, we often talk about the miracles of Jesus as if they're unidirectional. Jesus is the healer and offers healing to everybody else. But in this story, things are rearranged again and again and again. It is Jesus who is shown the power of touch. Not by a blazing fire from heaven, not by a high-ranking government military official with a title and a badge and power, but by a woman without a name, filled with desperate hope, clinging to his robes. I wonder then if this is why, when Jesus gets to the home of Jairus and the little girl, if this is why he takes her hand. Because in other healing stories, last week we heard about the man by the tombs. Jesus simply spoke to him and sent out the legion. A couple weeks ago, we heard about a man who couldn't walk and his friends lowered him on a mat in front of Jesus. Again, Jesus didn't touch him. He simply spoke words. Not that that's not impressive in and of its own right, but there's still a distance between the two. But today in this story, Jesus, as a grown man walking around with a crowd of people, experiences the vulnerability of being touched. And it changes him. In a day filled with interruptions, it is just as much a miracle to see how Jesus responds to these interruptions as it is to witness healing and life-giving way. He demonstrates a grace that is not too busy for those who seek help. He embodies God's divine yes to humanity, leaning into the vulnerable rather than ignoring and stepping away. I've often been told that when we're caught off guard, our true character has a way of sneaking out. We go through life with moments when we're backed into a corner or we're up against things we can't control. And I don't know about you, but when that happens, I'm really tempted to tell myself, things won't always be this way. This isn't normal. When things calm down, I can fix it all. I can straighten everything out and get back to where I need to be. And as long as I've worked in hospice and in healthcare in general, I've also heard the phrase, healthcare doesn't take a 9-to-5 schedule. People don't choose when the next crisis will come. And it constantly feels like I'm a character in a sitcom, kind of going along about my day and the writers are getting bored mid-season and they throw in a big plot twist just to keep the story arc moving. And 2 days ago on Friday, I had a particularly wonderful plot twist. So again, I've already established healthcare does not run 9-to-5 and I'll pretend to abide by those rules. But the thing is, Medicare, which oversees hospice, very much runs on a 9-to-5 schedule. So for this, for me, this means as a chaplain, I have to get every visit done and all of my charting completed by the end of the month, which was Friday. There's no room to just kind of get a fresh start when you're feeling better next week. No, 11:59 on Friday, that's it. And so with this model for me, I walk this line of being patient focused and also you gotta get your stuff done. It stresses me out sometimes. On the last day of the month, one of our chaplains called in sick. And since they were unable to complete their visits for the day, I had my visits to complete and theirs. Plot twist. I was not planning to go out east that day. But like Jesus, I got in my car or a boat and I traveled to the other side. The morning kept throwing one interruption after another at me. And by 11 a.m., I was ready to jump back in my boat and sail away and hide. It felt like too much. I was overwhelmed and I just wanted to get the visits done so I could move on to the next one. I had things to do. So I walk into a facility, walk into a residence room, and I see this wonderful woman in bed, sound asleep. And initially I'm thinking, she's sleeping. I can just walk out. No. As I walked up to her bed, I greeted her. Hi, I'm Kelsey, I'm the chaplain. And she opens up her eyes and her face just lights up. Oh, I'm so glad you're here. Now, the woman has dementia. I know she doesn't recognize me, but I recognized her. Over a year ago, I visited her pretty regularly. And when I first met her, she was a whopping 89 pounds. Tiny, tiny little thing. Sweetest, sweetest, wonderful person. And when I saw her 2 days ago, her frail body was covered with blankets and pillows to protect her frame. The bed was lowered down to the ground with a mat next to the bed in case she were to roll. So after she opened her eyes, I got down on the mat, sat on the floor, and she reached her hand out to me. And as I took her hand, she started talking for the next hour, telling me about all the wonderful people in the room. There was nobody else in the room that I could see, but she would point off into the corner and say, "That looks like my mom and my dad, and I love when they come to see me. I love when people come and smile at me. It makes me feel good." And then she would take my hand and press it up against her cheek, and she would just smile. In a day filled with interruptions, she stopped me, made me sit still long enough to experience the vulnerability of touch. She built a human connection with me. And although I was the one in the room with a name badge and a professional title, she was the one reminding me what it means to be human. Who touched me? May we learn to build, instead of a to-do list that is task-oriented, may we practice with each other a theology of interruptions, to remind each other to pause and wait when we feel the touch and the tug of those around us. May we be reminded that this touch is a call, an invitation for us to sit and wait for the divine presence that is already in our midst. And this presence, this touch, reminds us again and again what it means to be human. Amen.